History Department at UC Berkeley. There's my faculty profile up there. They can just get my email address. They can just shoot me an email, and I'm happy to engage with them.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on Transpositive.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. Our goal for this year is $70,000. We'd like to help you meet our goal. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KABU Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is listener supported. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KABU independent and non-commercial at kabu.fm/give. But right now, during our end of the year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kabu.fm/give today.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KABU's Community Advisory Board will meet Thursday, December 22nd from 6 to 8 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. At this time, masks are required for in-person attendees.
Tune in to KABU every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KABU FM.
Hello, my name is Bronte Velez, and I am so humbled to introduce this special episode on For the Wild. In this conversation, I join as a guest host to interview the brilliant and phenomenal and heart-centered and generous and right on time, Tiffany Lethabo King.
The land remembers you, right? Yeah. The land is making space for you. It remembers you. It's calling and pulling you towards it.
Tiffany Lethabo King, she, they, is a descendant of African people enslaved in the U.S. South. She grew up in Lenape Hokan and currently resides on Monacan lands. King is an associate professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at the University of Virginia. She is also a co-director of the Black and Indigenous Feminist Futures Institute, funded by the Mellon Foundation. Tiffany is the author of The Black Shoals, Offshore Formations of Black and Native Studies, published by Duke University Press in 2019. If you ain't got your copy, pick it up for you, a loved one, one of those free book libraries in your neighborhood. Get your copy. As a scholar and teacher, she is committed to thinking about how centuries-long relationships between Black and Indigenous peoples have provided openings to alternative pasts, presents, and futures. Black and Indigenous liberation struggles informed by feminist and queer politics, as well as artistic production and quotidian acts of survival and experimentation, inspires her forthcoming scholarly and community building work. I loved this conversation with Tiffany, and I am so grateful for what emerged in our time together. Our conversation traverses sacred laughter, Black and Indigenous feminisms, sexuality, liberation, ceremony, and protocol. It was recorded in January of 2021. Elements of our conversation score a project called Can I Get a Witness? A collaboration between For the Wild and Led to Life. Can I Get a Witness is a transmedia project that traces two queer Black Latinx femmes, myself and Steph Hewitt, dancing before and being danced by the ecology, memory, and stories of the Tongass National Forest and Glacier Bay in Southeast Alaska, unceded Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian territories. Scored by field recordings and music by Jordi Rosales and Jose Rivera, interviews from For the Wild podcast with Tiffany King, what you're about to hear, Wanda Kashutaha and Kasayage, matriarchal Tlingit elders and lifelong forest defenders of the Tongass and Glacier Bay, interviewed by Ayana Young, with footage from Molly Lebov and Jade Begay. The film and constellated media utilizes dance as a grammar to hold the complexity of its narrative, tracing connections between melting ice in Alaska and the disappearing Caribbean, the separation of Black and Indigenous relations, and the critical suture that Black and Indigenous femme survival requires the Earth's health. Quote, dance as a grammar, unquote, and quote, the land's refusal to be separated from flesh, unquote, are beautiful offerings and signifiers you'll hear from Tiffany King in this interview. I want to extend my deepest gratitude to the brilliant and dear Jasmine Calderon Torres, who is my research and thought partner, my chismetex, my spiritual companion for this interview. I appreciate you so much. Thank you, Jasmine, for your study, heart, wisdom, and prayer, all that you contributed for this interview to be possible. To the listeners, I hope this conversation between Tiffany and I opens imagination and healing for you. I hope it brings you joy. I encourage you to also encounter the filmic aspects of this conversation through Can I Get a Witness? Enjoy! I love that. I love that. Thank you for that affirmation and the way it relaxes my nervous system. And yeah, it tells me, affirms and confirms that I'm on the right path. And what you shared about moving toward Black livingness as opposed to an archive or, you know, an excavation around Black death made me think of someone I was trained under, Professor Greg Childs, who was at Brandeis University, who talked about, I remember the first time I heard him speak, he talked about a project he was working on looking at an enslaved rebellion in Brazil in the 18th century. And he's talking about how he was going through the archive in an attempt to kind of locate how this main instigator of the rebellion went about their sedition. And he found himself in his excavation actually taking on the life and posture of slave catcher. And he was saying, you know, this finding this will be really perhaps good for my book or for the academy or the conferences I go to have this writing or text that no one has ever had, but actually for those people at that moment, those Black folks in Brazil, to not be found allows them to still be free and to be fugitive. And what am I really trying to find? And I loved that reapproach to protecting fugitivity, protecting Mirnage, and how to, what Juliette Singh talks about, this idea that no archive will restore you. I really love this kind of like, how do we be careful with how we approach history, how we approach historiography. And in that, I wanna kinda come back. I wanna come back to the shoal and what happened where you began to use the shoal as what you call your organizing metaphor. And how did the shoal, it sounded like the shoal encountered you through kind of continuing to pass Flat Shoals Row, which I grew up right near. I'm curious how the shoal encountered you to reimagine your scholarship around Black and Native studies and relations. And where were you before you encountered the shoal? How were you approaching the work?
No, thank you for all of that. We're gonna have to definitely come back to what your professor was saying about like taking on the persona and embodiment of slave catchers. That people are so close to having that happen all the time in the academy. You have to actively work against that. So thank you for that reminder. And in all forms of work, I'm sure. But you know, I often tell this story about the geography that you grew up around and on, right? When I'm talking to folks about this organizing metaphor of the shore, I know that I was looking for a space of encounter, both between Black and Indigenous folks and the metaphors that academic fields often rely on, like the Black Atlantic or the Oceanic for diasporan Black folks, right? And terra and land for Indigenous folks. And I'm like, where do those metaphors and geographies meet up and touch each other and become something different? And for a while, I was probably 3 years deep into like actually working on the manuscript, and was dealing with the shoreline, right? I had all these files that I was working on, like an intro, the chapter one, chapter two, and I kept coming back to the intro, and I was thinking and reworking and always struggling with the fact that the shore wasn't enough. Like, it was just something that the shore wasn't doing for me, Bronte, and it was like, well, I don't know, is it that like the shore is something that nations often claim, right? They get incorporated into nation states and become a part of territory very easily, right? If you look at any kind of like televisual or filmic kind of recreation of a scene of conquest where the explorers and conquistadors are coming onto shore, they plant a flag there. And I'm like, that's not the place, right? And I was just struggling and searching and doing a lot of labor to figure out something else. And I couldn't write myself into it. Like literally W-R-I-T-E, I could not write myself into it. And so I was, you know, on a very deep subconscious level in a place of searching, but just doing a very mundane thing of driving, like a lot of my other mundane kinds of activities of, like, unfortunately, like being on my phone before bed or washing dishes, other things would come to me, right? When I wasn't so aggressively and actively trying to sort things out analytically, just in the kind of act of driving and letting myself flow with the particular kind of urban and even gentrified geography that now Flat Shoals is, things just started to like move, right? There was a certain, when I stopped being so muscular about the searching, like all of these things could then, I could be aware of and be more open to. So literally after years of driving down flat shoals in this space of need and openness, right? Moving through the landscape, I decided to pay attention, right? My body was just ready to pay attention in a deeper and more meaningful way to how these geographical markers, even some of them being settler markers, right? That street sign did not emerge because of Muscogee people naming this place, right? So again, the white kind of shifting of geographies and using those geographic metaphors, I was like, what is a shoal, right? And like wow. thought about, this is what I need, because a shoal not only is a place where the ocean floor comes up to meet the surface of the water, it moves, right? If it's a sand formation or a coral formation, over time, that shoal is not going to be in the same place. It's elusive. Also, shoals are dangerous, right? Before the 19th century, where there was a way to do like a cross section of the ocean and people had been able to map through sound where the ocean floor rose up, ships would be wrecked. People would die, right? The entire cargo would be lost, right? They're dangerous, right? They force these vessels where I imagine these white conquistadors, come settlers who are enslaving people, they have to be careful, their lives are at jeopardy. So I'm like, this shoal does so much and I have to think with it. It's giving me something that the shore is not, right? And so it also made me think about the different kinds of attentions we have with our bodies, right? Like what it means to be creating work and where we have to listen and where we have to feel. And that this is not just a fully cerebral kind of project. And that cerebral kind of activity is a thing that the university privileges, right? And they, even if people are having, particularly white subjects are having experiences like these that rely on other kinds of senses, you're not supposed to talk about that because that's not real intellectual labor. But I was like, no, I have to actually acknowledge all of the ways that the spirit conspired, that the landscape conspired, that a landscape that has been dominated and reworked and gentrified, right, through our notion of what the human has to do to space and land, broke through that day, right? And wow. gave me something else. So And the geography where you grew up, right, was pulsing and speaking to me. So, wow. Yeah, that's how that happened.
Ooh, that is potent. It makes me tingle all over thinking about, I think so much about scholar Alori Palmer, who I believe is out of UC Santa Cruz, whose text In the Aura of a Whole has really impacted me. It's about sites of material extraction, and she's visiting all of these different places that are out of view, where they're extracting helium and aluminum and processing all of these elements that are so essential to our material lives. And she has this part in her opening where she talks about imagining a gentle matter and how difficult some of these elements are to actually process, the millions of dollars of manufacturing going into taking them out of the ground. And can we imagine that the matter has agency and refusal to be extracted, and that they're making people do a lot of work to take them out of their resting place? And I just imagine that what you just said, that feels like it's from another part of the body and spirit of the shoal, even if displaced and even if the geography has been paved over and cemented and gentrified and changed, and you no longer know what the earth there is like, that even still they snuck their way into the sign for you to see it, the street sign. It's just, and even if disturbed by the colonial project of the street sign, they still found their way through, which I think is really, really powerful, of imagining the earth as in consort with the work that you're doing. And I keep thinking about how you use a geologic grammar. And I'm wondering about how, yeah, the earth changed your relationship to English, because I've noticed in the text you're letting the shoal literally straight up speak through you. And yeah, I'm just wondering how that changed your relationship to English.
Ooh, that's a deep question. And I think that, I don't even know, again, timing is key. The fact that I'm having this conversation with you after Monday is allowing so many things to come together for me, because I just had a conversation with folks from Dark Laboratory, like Tal Gulf and Electric Marinage, Jessica Marie Johnson, and Jomaira Figuera, who we were talking about decoloniality. And we got to senses through Jomaira's work, Decolonizing Diasporas. There's a chapter in her book, Destierro, where she's talking about the violent process of ripping Black and Indigenous people from the land, and how we reconnect to land and soil. And she talks about characters in a novel and their consuming of grass, right, and eating the earth, and was talking about pica, right, and salt in Spanish, right, and destierro in Spanish, as things that cannot be translated, and there is no true English translation that gets at the violence or that kind of craving and appetite of pica for land, right?
Wow.
And so there is a way that, you're right, the shoal is doing something that always exceeds English, but also exceeds what language, as far as like the written kind of orthographic, putting letters on and markings on a page, and even what we think can be translated into human language. Like, there's a way that our ecologies transcend that mode of communication. And Jomaira made me think about the work of LaMonda Stallings, L.H. Stallings, who recently wrote A Dirty South Manifesto. And LaMonda talks about, in a context of the U.S. South, and then she also talks about this craving of dirt in particular. So not necessarily soil, something with nutrients, but dirt, matter that has been displaced, often because of violent modes of genocide and enslavement and displacement. But Black people's desire for that, whether it's in urban spaces on the continent in Africa or in the U.S. South, and certainly Jomaira could pull us to the Caribbean, but this desire to eat dirt, she reframes it as actually the land's refusal to be separated from flesh. Oof. That wow. Sent me.
Wow.
Right? Like, your actual bodily desire is a pulling from the earth, because the earth refuses to be separated from you. So it will make you crave it, right? So talk about agency, right? And that sense of the erotic. And I had Bronte, so as a part of like my scaffolding, that everything that could bring me to the shoal, it brought me back to, I think it was 2014. So this is before I even had a book project. I was like still thinking about, I just wrote a dissertation, I have nothing in me. There's no way I can write a book. I'm probably gonna lose my job. Like, I just, whatever. I just wrote a dissertation. Like, I don't know what y'all want from me, right? But it takes me back to like how the land was working on me. I went on this incredible hike with these two Black folks who, one had left Russia, the other was a brother who had grown up in like Portland, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. They met on some interesting dating site that was like literally this Black woman from Russia and this Black US born man come together in Keshwara, in the mountains of Keshwara in Bahia, take me on this hike on a dry riverbed, Rio Preto. And I was freaked out, Bronte. I told this story on Monday. I was like, you know, I had gotten into this weird mode where I was kind of out of balance and not dipping into like moving with joy. So like I hadn't really like worked my heart and my lungs in the way I needed to before going on this hike. And they're like, be ready. So like make sure, you know, you're limber, you're doing your movements, didn't listen. Didn't showed up unprepared. Didn't do what they said and was freaking out because it was really, it required a lot of exertion. Like right before then we had like climbed for like 800 meters, like literally using my hands and my feet to climb. And wow. Then we're on this riverbed. So I was exhausted and it was kind of still slick, right? So there wasn't water coursing through it, but it's still slick. Moss, other kinds of life is there. And I felt like I was gonna twist an ankle or twist a knee, and I was freaking out and I had to calm myself down. And when it was like the spirit of like breathe and trust was there, and when I was moving after I had calmed down and just kind of surrendered to the energy of that riverbed without a lot of effort, rarely any, like there was always a place to put my foot, like a small space that was perfectly made for like the tip of my foot, the ball of my foot, that put me on secure ground. So I could deeply relate to what LaMonda was talking about and what Jackie Alexander is talking about. The land remembers you, right? Yeah. The land is making space for you. It remembers you. It's calling and pulling you towards it. And so I think that that 2014 experience also worked on my body in a way to prepare me to be in a place to be open to the shoal, right? Wow. Even a shoal that was invisible, as you said, manipulated English language and appeared on a sign for me, right? There was all this other stuff that happened before I got to writing this book, right?
Bahia will do it. Bahia will really do it. I feel that about that place very deeply. And yeah, tracing back a moment of just thinking of 2 years ago on my birthday, I was leaving. I felt like I was going through an initiation after a ceremony that led to life held in Oakland, unceded Ohlone territory, where we had transformed guns with the crucible into these molds that were stars, that were the constellations above Oscar Grant the evening he was murdered 10 years prior. And there had just been a lot of calling of like, okay, I want to be working at a different level. And I started to speak without care or protection. I started to say that I wanted an initiation, which I really wish I hadn't said in that way or been more specific, which I'm learning now when you invoke things, you need to be really specific. And I went on our birthday to Salvador, and I was feeling called to be there because it's the day that they honor Yemayá. And I wanted to feel this kind of initiatory moment with land, with the orishas, with my solar return. And all to say, I ended up getting on our birthday, I got attacked. And while in Brazil, I got robbed, and my offerings almost got taken. but my whole bag, and I had these offerings to give to the ocean, and I had already gotten in the water, and I just started asking Yemaya for things for my life, and there was no presence. And this is not to say that, you know, if I would have prayed, I wouldn't have been hurt. It's not that simple. But there was this correction I felt, a spiritual correction I felt after. I was safe, I was fine. I was able to look at this person where it really felt spiritual, and to look them in their eyes and be like, you don't know who you're fucking with. You don't know who you're robbing right now. You don't know what state I'm in and what impact this is gonna have. And it also brought me into this moment of Black Americanhood and this Black man in Brazil taking from me. And there was so much going on a spiritual level. And I remember after shaking, the sun is now rising, it's our birthday, and the fireworks are going and the offerings are starting to be, the offerings are beginning to be taken out to the water. And I end up now finding my friends again, and we can barely understand each other. I was set up with them. We're trying to speak between Spanish and Portuguese, and they tell me to just bring my hand to the water because my hand had been injured in this event. And I remember coming to the water shaking. I was shaking, and I felt the ocean there take me in the way that I think my body wanted to. I think my body actually, not on some like I deserve the hurt, but that ocean and what I had come for was actually that I wanted to come with that level of reverence for my body to be in that state of shaking, of trance of the Holy Ghost, and of coming to water with reverence. And I've never related to the earth flippantly since. I've never gone back to the earth without bringing my offerings and without giving thanks and without acknowledging where I am and trusting what it means that there are other powers at play moving. And it makes me think about some of your, when we're talking about the flesh and the earth actually wanting our flesh, it makes me think about your language around Black feminist flesh analytics and Native feminist flesh analytics. And I don't know, I think I know what you mean, but I would love to hear, yeah, how that language weaves into, and how your theory around the flesh analytics weaves into this craving of the earth for our presence with them, not for our death, which I think white supremacy and terrorism and all of these things has meant that our bodies have come back to the earth too early, but rather this eros, this erotic relationship of our bodies and the land.
That was heavy, Bronte.
Yeah.
That was heavy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, thank you for that. That was a lot of deep sharing right there. And I agree with you. Like, the Atlantic Ocean in particular does not play. Yeah. Oh my gosh, it does not play. Is that, that's where you...
Yeah, I was at the Atlantic.
Yo, I had an experience with the Atlantic in Puerto Rico on a similar kind of taking for granted. That I was on a day excursion in between conference sessions when our conference should not have even been in Puerto Rico, number one. So again, diaspora people, watch how you travel, right? Mm. The ethics of travel, how you decide to encounter other diaspora people who are saying, look, we're colonized.
Mm-hmm.
We're in an antagonistic relationship with the nation that you're coming from, right?
Right.
So step carefully, perhaps come when you're invited, right? I didn't do that. And I thought I was gonna have a pleasurable, like, just waiting with the Atlantic. I got worked. There were moments I was scared, and I'm a pretty strong swimmer.
Mm.
I've been swimming for a long time. My daddy taught me really early, right?
Mm.
the ocean was like, not today, hon. I had to get out. I was worn out for the rest of a week. It was like, no. Try again on some other terms. Not today. We're not playing with you. But yeah, like, to get back to your question of flesh and alchemies of flesh, I'm starting to think and feel through it seriously, really for the first time, like right now, to like give it some deep attention. I'm not done with the flesh. I know that it has become a heavily circulated keyword. That's what I'm gonna say, in the academy, in the humanities right now, and used all kinds of ways. Some that I recognize, resonate with, totally appreciate, vibe with, you know, the way that people have given attention to what Hortense Spillers is doing is really important. There are other people doing wild stuff with it. People who don't want to be transformed by a Black feminist word are doing wild stuff with it. And I'm trying to let that notion of flesh, particularly around its erotic lines and pulses, change me in the way that you're saying. And so one of the things that I appreciate that you just said is I want to deal with how the fleshiness of the earth works on us and calls us, particularly Black folks. And I had been a little bit stuck, and one of my colleagues helped me get unstuck. And what I mean by that is I was in, wow, again, another space where the Academy invited me, as well as some other colleagues, Hawaii, right? Mm-hmm. Another space that I didn't have enough contacts. Like, I was able to connect with the brilliant artist and poet Joy Enomoto, who helped us create space and introduced us to, and reintroduced us to, some spaces that we needed to be in right relationship with while we were in Hawaii. But I was on a panel and I was struggling, and I was trying to articulate that I wondered if there was a way for Indigenous folks and Black folks, so Indigenous folks of many nations and Black folks of many ethnicities and nations and kinds of identities that exceeded nation and state, to develop a shared language. And I was struggling with it, and I was openly just kind of struggling with where are the spaces that we're code switching, we're speaking the same language, but specifically about land. And I was like, I don't know if we necessarily have it. And I don't know if that's a problem. It's certainly not a deficiency on Black studies part or Black people's part. And my colleague, Circes Mendez, who takes Santeria seriously in that kind of ceremonial space and what happens to what we know is Western gender in that space, how it's reoriented and reconfigured, was like, maybe you're focusing too much on language itself, and there are some restrictions around that. Just in the way that you're talking about English, Bronte, everything is not about language, what you say or write. Some of it is in dance, right? Mm-hmm. And she was like, you know, think about the dance for Yemaya, right? That's deeply about the water and ecology. That's its own kind of grammar, right? What happens at the level of the body, that again can't be translated, has to be experienced, co-witnessed between Black and Indigenous people. So it's bringing me to Black and Indigenous spaces of ceremony, perhaps even since you gifted me with this laughter, right? Gut-busting laughter, right? That's the space of the flesh. And that's the alchemy I'm trying to get to, like the doing and the changing and the transforming that I'm trying to get to and articulate. And we'll certainly be thinking with the work you're doing, particularly dance that you're doing. I can't wait to see some pieces of this project, at least those that could have been, I guess, archived for us through video, moving image, and even still, again, beyond the body, but the flesh. What is flesh? Flesh both at the ecological level, land, water, sky, and our flesh is deeply connected to that, what does that mean? What is that changing and shaping and manifesting and giving us? So that's what I think I'm feeling through and working through right now. And we'll see what it means to bring that to language and what other tools I have to use, perhaps performance and voice, and some non-spoken things to get to that.
Wow. Thank you. Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you to the bringing in the dance. It feels like that. And I was thinking about how you're kind of dancing. I don't recall what chapter. I think it's your chapter around the erotic and Native and Indigenous, Black and Indigenous relations, where you start to kind of speak about this dance or this distance between the language of sovereignty and abolition, and this question if is the word coalition, can that do it for us? You talk about how, quote, perhaps coalition, as Billy Ray Belcourt argues about sovereignty, has been weighted down in political speak. I contend that discourses of coalition often foreclose conversations about sex, erotics, and Black and Indigenous futures, unquote. And I've been thinking about this kind of your questions that I feel are so critical around the concepts of Native sovereignty and anti-Black racism and all of the things that sovereignty means. And is it the word? Is it about place? Is it about the earth? Is it about the nation state? And you offer this question, quote, while Native sovereignty as a concept has stretched and changed due to the stress of internal pressure, can it change in relation to Black people's needs and desires? I wonder if you might speak to more around complicating the concepts of sovereignty. And also, you spoke to a reviewer challenging you back about, they said, quote, for whom is sovereignty important and in what moment? And so I wonder about this dance between, yeah, sovereignty and Black abolition. Where does Black liberation live in Native sovereignty? Where does Native sovereignty and Black liberation actual, or Native liberation, find discord or friction? And how might intimacy or queerness kind of, yeah, shift that relationship? And where does language fail us in that imagination?
Yeah, that was a chapter that really challenged me for a number of reasons, just to, again, right at the edge and the limits of language that Billy Ray Belcourt really helped me think about, right? His work was critical for allowing an opening, right? I see Belcourt's work as pressing on the question of Native sovereignty in a deep way, in which, one, Billy Ray Belcourt is invested in Native people's liberation and freedom and emancipation, like seriously as a Cree person, right? And had an ethical engagement with perhaps some of the hard edges of the way that political speak trapped these really capacious and porous notions of sovereignty, right? And was, as a poet, was paying attention to where Western language and notions of like bounded individual selves crept into, in violent ways, Indigenous notions of fleshiness, right? Of erotics, of a capacity to change and change in relationship to the other. And I extended his discussion of that space of erotics. And he's explicitly, as a queer and Indigenous queer theorist, talking about sex, right? So literally talking about that space as being a space of radical encounter, mm-hmm. right? and saying that, yeah, there's something that political speech is not giving us that our own erotic practices and desires can give us. And we need to turn to that if we really want to think about Indigenous futures, right? And wasn't explicitly trying to speak to Black studies, but I thought I found him deeply engaged with some of the ways that Afro-pessimists, I'm speaking specifically of Jared Sexton's The Veil of Slavery, was troubling Native studies. And I really think that there was a conflation happening between white settler colonial studies and Native studies, and who's calling them the same thing when they're not, right? Because it's certainly his form of Native studies or Native decolonization was one that didn't account for Billy Ray Belcour's thoughts, right? And Billy Ray Belcour's notion of what Indigenous futurity meant. And so I was really trying to deal with this debate, right, that said, you know, Native sovereignty is really about recognition, and that's something that Black folks don't have. And I was like, I don't think so. And this is the problem. Yeah, with us not talking to each other, which is not the fault of the individual scholar, right? There's a way that Black studies gets cordoned off from or sequestered from Native studies when you're an academic, right? And when you produce from the space of the academy and you're not necessarily in relationship with, I'm not gonna say in coalition with, in relationship with Indigenous folks outside of the academy and even outside of political spaces like nonprofit organizations or a formal coalitional group, there's a lot that you miss about how Black folks and Indigenous folks are trying to relate to one another, right? There are not just nuances, but the kind of fleshy transformative experiences that we have with one another, like in the trenches with one another, right? And I can't believe that I'm forgetting this person's name. Melanie Yazzie, Shania Curtis, and I were on a roundtable at Spelman, and this sister who I really feel like she is from perhaps the Southwest, and I don't want to definitely misname her and her nation and her people, but she was talking about her experience of being a sex worker and living with another sex worker and negotiating the kind of violence that they both experienced and caring for one another. So her sister was in need of surgery, and so she was talking about how she had to go on, I think it was Backpage at the time. There was I don't know if it was Kamala Harris, who was trying to like criminalize the use of that particular like classified space in publications, print and online publications that sex workers were using. They're trying to regulate it in the name of helping out sex workers, right? But it was talking about having to do some sex work that was precarious in order to help her friend get the medical care that she needed. And so she was talking about that as like deep relational space. And so I'm like, when folks in the academy talk about coalition and Black and Indigenous relations as being fraught and hindered by notions of sovereignty, they don't think about those spaces, like the everyday spaces where we need each other to survive and what we're willing to risk, put on the line, care for each other, that again, like Billy Ray Belcour is saying, exceeds language. Like it's not, this issue of sovereignty, both for Black and Indigenous people, cannot be overwritten as something that's already resolved or decided for us by Western language. And if we get really honest with ourselves and our desire and attraction for people, particularly interracially, like who we're deciding to partner with, we're doing a lot of stuff that folks might say is deeply coalitional, right? But you won't call it that because it's your personal life and you don't want to bring it to the surface and have people scrutinize it. But people are working out their relationship to white people, Indigenous people, folks of color, Black folks are doing this through like who they choose to have as partners, mm. right? And talk about that. And that's where the stuff gets real. That's mm. where we figure out how we're invested in one another's well-being and futurity. And those are the terms in which we need to probably discuss it. Like we can't, like Billy Ray Belcour is like, we can't keep it cute. Like we really can't. This stuff is complicated and we're working it out. And that needs to be a space of theory. Like, let's be honest.
Yeah, it makes me think how critical pleasure is to this work, and how often it's the relationship is about some sort of, the relationship is about organizing, or, you know, yeah, changing our conditions, or speaking to the state, or imagining that the state is what will kind of give us our power. And what our work is to do is to kind of collaborate in order to receive those reparations or freedom from the state, rather than to perhaps find what is possible between one another. And what's possible beyond, yeah, what's possible beyond, what's possible inside of other sites of power. It makes me think in your new text that you are, the anthology that you're editing, that you just edited, Otherwise Worlds, Chris Finley comes in and talks about this kind of language of failing our way into intimacy, and how we might embrace failure in the attempt towards intimacy, and says, quote, "After all, isn't working together a move toward intimacy? Hasn't this always been a bit icky, scary, and awkward? Why do we expect each other to be perfectly formed political subjects when we've all been institutionalized to think badly of each other and ourselves?" And I loved this kind of imagining of marronage and the possibilities and pleasure of that could come through failure, which I think is something we're too afraid to actually be willing to do. And I think that we're going to fail. And I think there's grief in that. And I think grief as a part of the practice needs to be there. When I think of the possibilities of ceremony and grief work and rage and hurt, what the body is allowed to do when in that deep eros, to scream and yell out, to transcend, to share breath, you know, these other things we were talking about, to stay in the body, to be loved, really to be loved. And I think there's so many spaces I feel like that we haven't imagined that could allow us to do that for one another. So yeah, I'm curious as we close, last night when I was talking to my partner Jordy, we were talking about where do we meet beyond the wound, Black and Indigenous folks? Is the wound the only place that we can meet? We were thinking of Dr. Bio Komolafe, a colleague and friend's language that he often brings up around dehiscence, or I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's dehiscence, but it means it's a surgical complication where the edges of a wound no longer meet. And I was thinking a lot about this, not wanting to only focus on our wounds, but are our wounds the only place that we meet? And I see you in your project describing, you know, quote, dragging settler colonial logic offshore. How does that provide, what does that provide to the dance of how we get free with one another? And is the shoal we were talking about, is the shoal actually a time, not a place? And how we might want to displace liberation, because we were chatting about this Elder Orland Bishop who said to me when I was headed from Oakland to Memphis to be and sit at the Lorraine Motel before Led to Life's 50th anniversary ceremonies of Dr. King's assassination. I said to him, I don't know why I'm taking the train. And he said, it's because you're going to a time, not a place. And the act of marching was actually the anticipation of knowing that we were committing and agreeing to another relationship to time, to our freedom. And so the body and the gesture moving through place was just acknowledging that agreement. And so a couple of different things there as we end: failure, intimacy, time, and what's beyond the wound here for us with Black and Indigenous folks, if you might leave us with a little prophecy.
Woo! You can't leave me with that. Our dwindling time. And we will reconnect on this. But I think you said it. Wow, like marching is the creation of time, right? And the preparation for a shift. Like, why am I... Yeah, this is about moving to a time. And it makes me think, to try to encapsulate some of my thoughts and move towards where you're thinking of taking us beyond the wound of Black and Indigenous betrayal, or where we may have been perceived to betray each other. I had just had the opportunity on Monday to think about this, because someone who was in the audience of our panel for Dark Laboratory and Electric Marinage was asking specifically about a map that I look at, an 18th century map in my second chapter, and why I had not focused more on the Cherokee practice of slavery, right? And it was like, I definitely want to address that and talk to that, but I also was challenged to and invited the challenge of thinking about a time before that became the central narrative about Cherokee and Black people's relationship. And it was a time where I could locate a time, right? That 1757 map where Black life and Indigenous life was oriented towards insurrection, right? And a resistance, a mutual kind of resistance to fell a particular kind of conquistador settler order. So on that map, I see that, right? That was before, not that there hadn't been moments of betrayal where the Cherokee were not returning captives, but before slavery had become an institution, right? And a capital making kind of venture for the Cherokee Nation, right? It was before that. And it was also a place where, I was talking to Jessica Marie Johnson about the use of forts, the ways that conquistador settlers were using forts. There were also places of imprisonment. There were holding cells, right? There were places where both folks who had been captured, Cherokee folks who had been captured, who were part of warring forces who were trying to beat back the settlers, and also enslaved folks who were planning insurrection or planning slave rebellions, they were held together, right? They were held in those forts as captives together. So our initial spaces of incarceration, right, were ones that were Black and Indigenous spaces of capture, right? And so I was thinking about, we not only have the wounds, right, of the Cherokee practice of slavery, but we have a time before then where that deal had not been wagered, right? Mm. Those particular terms of Cherokee sovereignty had not had not been settled, right? And so we have times while we still have the wound, we have times before, we have times after, right? Not that the afterlife of slavery and that trauma isn't still with us, particularly around the freedmen, right? But still, we have times to revisit and think about our relationship of rebellion to conquest and the settler colonial project here. And I feel, again, the pulse of that, a revisiting of that time so forcefully right now, Bronte, through the work you're doing, the work that my colleagues are doing, particularly Indigenous and Native feminists are doing, because we can access those times.
We do
have the capacity to access those moments, right? And reinvigorate them and reactivate them and bring them into a now. We do. So thank you for that offering of time, right? Another kind of decolonial time.
Thank you for listening to part two of Bronte Velez's conversation with Tiffany Lethabo King. The music you heard today was by Jordi Rosales and Ashia Karana. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Francesca Glassbell, and Julia Jackson.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you